do have a timeout. Decide not to use it. Curry, way downtown. Bang! Bang! Oh, what a shot from Curry! With 0.6 seconds remaining.
The brilliant shot. Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
For us.
He scores! Australia have got it!
Yes, the NBA anti-climaxes.
Yeah. Well, that was all great. It's kind of sad that if there is going to be an asterisk on this season, it's going to be because all the Miami players are injured in the finals and we'll never actually know whether this could have been a contest. Well, spoilers, it probably wasn't ever going to be.
Yeah, look, there's two things. One is...
One's AD and one's LeBron. They're your two things.
That's true. Turns out having two of the top four or five players is pretty handy thing to have.
Yeah.
There's sort of two things. One is Miami were a side that had to have everything go right and everyone play well just to get there. And it was like a finely tuned machine and all you needed was one little speck of dust, let alone three little specks of dust, and you're fucked.
Well, literally, the complete opposite happened in game one, didn't it? It was like everything went wrong, and they're still paying for that in game two, which happened today. They were always going to lose game two, and the fact that they stayed within 10 for most of the game was kind of a tribute to their effort levels. And it was also a day where, in the first game, the Lakers shooting from outside was unsustainably good. It kind of bounced back to normal levels in game two, but it didn't really matter because the talent gap without Bam and Goran and out there was just going to tell the story.
The thing that's getting me, though, is the Ramona Shelburne-ish, and it's not just her, there's a few of them writing these pieces about the Lakers' exceptionalism of it all and how Davis had to go to the Lakers to truly be the player that he wanted to be. And
I mean, is that any more vomitiferous than the Heat culture pieces? I mean, I think there's a lot of fucking terrible narrative shit that's going on and on and on. And that's what happens in the finals, is that stories get written to say that these are the teams that always should have been in the finals, particularly if you work for the company that's actually televising them. So they're writing puff pieces for both sides of the story. And that's exactly what they should be doing.
I don't actually think actually, the best story I read this week was from Jackie Mack, which shocked the fuck out of me because I find her to be a bit of a homer, but...
A bit?
Yeah. That was me doing an understatement.
She's been quietly retired from the rotation on Windhurst Pod, which is, I'm not going to say massively improved it, but it certainly hasn't made it worse.
Yeah. She wrote a really good piece about the sort of pressure and how different players sort of build up the relationship to pressure and how they deal with it, and had a really interesting bit about Curry where, you know, Curry's essentially trained himself to be sort of dispassionate and not ride the adrenaline wave, which is sort of like the anti-Jimmy Butler or the anti-Kyrie or the anti of a lot of players. And
he's a golfer, isn't he? I mean...
Yeah, that's right. He is. That's
a golfer,
the sort of...
And the last thing you want to be is off your chops on adrenaline when you're a golfer. And his game is predicated on the ability to sharpshoot from distance.
Mm. So he sort of tells the story about how his body was feeling when he had that miss, you know, when he got the switch against Kevin Love in the series that they lost, and how he literally just felt like hero ball coursing through his veins and, you know, pulled up and went for the big shot. And as soon as it left his hands, was like, no, that was a fucking bad move. You know, you had 4 seconds. You should have just blown past him, gone for the layup and then, you know, got the stop and gone back and had another crack. And for all of that to run through his mind within, you know, 1 or 2 seconds, it's just amazing self-analysis, I reckon.
Yeah, but time slows down when you're...
Yeah, that's true.
When you've got, you know, years and years to dwell on the fact after you're fucked up and you've got years and years to dwell on it afterwards. Well, they didn't have that long. They reloaded with KD and went out and beat everybody, and that's why they're so likable.
Yeah. Look, next year is going to be just like, I know the sort of narrative in the NBA is whoever wins is sort of seen as somewhat inevitable the next year, but man, that the NBA is going to be wide open.
Not this year. Well, it's going to be squeaky bum time for the Clippers, is it not? Having fired Doc Rivers this week, and I'm sure we'll get to where Doc ended up in due course. But it certainly seems like it felt like they made a change without necessarily knowing exactly what they were going to do next.
Well, I wonder whether Doc's actually helped them out there, because Ty Lue seemed to be fairly popular choice at Philly. But even this decision just smacks of the Philly stupidity, and that the Philly owners wanted D'Antoni, the GM.
Why are we talking about Philly? Can we dwell on the Clippers' stupidity first before we get to Philly's stupidity? I mean, when you fire a perfectly reasonable championship coach with no backup plan, and all you're going to do is promote his 2IC, who's been part of all of the same fucking locker room bullshit the Doc has been part of.
Yep.
Is that going to fix things when you've got 1 year left with Kyrie and Paul George?
Well, you might not even have one year with Paul George. I would not be surprised if
he's... waving goodbye to all those fucking picks as you go. I mean, that's kind of the thing with Doc. I thought that the best narrative sort of next job for him would be go to OKC. Profit off all those chips that have been sent there for all the players.
The only thing is, I suppose Presti would be making the picks for him, but he's a terrible draft. You know, his drafting is terrible.
Well, that's why he got demoted from basically being, you know, like a Stan Van Gundy-style president of basketball operations down to just being a coach, and then finally just not being a coach at all.
Yeah, is Ty Lue... I guess Ty Lue at least has...
not a slam dunk for that job, because he's getting interviewed in the Rockets vacancy. He's getting interviewed in one or two other spots as well.
Well, if you're Ty Lue, do you want that job? Because in 1 year's time, it could turn into Cleveland 2.0. Like, if they don't play well next year and Kawhi and Paul George are gone and you've got no draft picks, well, what? That's a terrible job. That might be a terrible job in 12 months' time.
Yeah, but to a certain extent, you've got to be Billy Donovan and you've got to say, look, what's the longest number of years?
Yeah.
With the highest dollar figure at the end of it. And know that, you know, if you get fired, you're going to get paid out. I mean, if Ty Lue signs for 5 years at lots of money, and then he gets fired after a year and a half when Kyrie and Paul George walk after they fail next year because the Warriors will be back and the Lakers will be better and so on and so forth, he's sitting on the beach with 3 years still to go on this very big contract. At the end of the day, you're still going to get paid.
The Pelicans don't have a coach yet, do they?
The Pelicans are one of the teams that want to interview Ty Lue.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That sort of makes more sense because of the GM relationship there, I guess.
Well, I was surprised by how quick, and getting back to the Sixers, I was surprised by how quick the Sixers went for Doc.
I guess he's good at, except, you know, the last two superstar matchups that he's, you know, pairings that he's had, he hasn't done that well at making them work together. Like, Chris Paul and Griffin for years were, everyone said, oh, they don't particularly like each other and they don't like playing with each other. The chemistry this year at the Clippers, after being really good, was terrible.
I think that's got a lot more to do with the people they brought in. And I feel like for a lot of those, with the Griffin, CP3, DeAndre Jordan Clippers, I think they've got as far as they were ever going to get with
the
collection of talent.
He maximized them out.
They were as much of an achievement. And you also saw last year what Doc could do with a developing side.
I guess the positive thing is that he probably got the most out of Tobias Harris than any coach has ever got out of him. You know, Harris was a really good player for him. So if you can turn him into a really good number three, then that's a pretty good side then, if you've got three really good players. I don't know. It's fascinating. The Philly.
It feels like an Elton Brand move, though, doesn't it? It really feels like Elton Brand's just bringing his old boss back.
Well, evidently the owners wanted D'Antoni, and Brand didn't want a bar of D'Antoni, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So Doc was like the
D'Antoni has a reputation now of being the absolute run and gun, and that's not. I mean, that's obviously not going to work with Simmons and Embiid. So
not both of them.
D'Antoni has a reputation. I mean, back in the dim distant past, D'Antoni could actually run an offense that wasn't running and gunning, and he's very, very good at building offenses. I've got no doubt he could have built something that worked around Embiid and Simmons. But I can also see how Embiid and Simmons' skills would work better. The sorts of offenses and the sorts of schemes that Doc uses would probably work better with those tools than a D'Antoni offense.
It's definitely, if you were Doc, I think that's the best job to grab. It's just the most talent. There's more talent there than anywhere else, because the talent in the Pelicans is sort of unshaped. It's unrealized yet.
Yeah, and it's in the East. I mean, let's not get away from that point. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, the Heat were the best team in the East, and they're not even close to being the match of the Lakers as currently constituted.
Yeah, that's sort of like the Raptors and the Celtics really are diminished by the way that the Heat are just being blown off the floor. Like, I realize there's injuries, but they just don't look like they're a match for the best team in the West. And
given the way that the Heat undid, particularly the Heat and the Bucks, it's hard to imagine they would have done better against the Lakers. I mean, one of the things that you forget, I mean, obviously AD and LeBron are, nuclear weapons, but Vogel also coaches up a tremendous defense. And this is the best defense that the Heat have actually had to face. And they suck at trying to score points right now.
Probably the best antidote to the way the Lakers are playing is the the fact that the Warriors aren't there sort of make it, you can play that smash mouth defense with lots of big bodies. You know, the Warriors are the one side that could probably really hurt you. And there's just no one out there.
Imagine a Warriors. I mean, the Warriors that they have now haven't existed. I mean, you've got to put away all those memories of the KD Warriors and go back to the...
No, I'm more thinking, the Warriors beforehand, the Bogut Warriors, which is essentially what they've got. You know, Wiggins is your Barnes analogy. That's what they're going to try and go back to those 72-win Warriors. Now, is Draymond Green the same Draymond Green that he was then?
Clay going to be the same player coming off the injuries that he's had? I mean, those are not injuries that it's easy to come back from. Knees and Achilles, ACLs and Achilles are things that you never come back quite the same from.
Yeah, I think Curry will still be Curry.
Well, the thing is, Curry, I mean, I think we've said in months previous, at least Curry's major injuries were bone breaks.
Yeah.
And that actually, they will heal, whereas, ligaments have to be reattached and they come back more calloused and more knotted up and less flexible and more likely to pop again. So, and you come back compensating for them, so you're more likely to injure yourself again.
Yeah, I wonder whether the extra long break will help Clay there in the fact that he's not being, he's getting a full rehab. You know, he's not getting a sort of come back as soon as you can. It's like, well, we can ease you in as much as we like. That'll be interesting to see, I guess.
It worries me though, because a lot of what Clay does is move off the ball, and that's the sort of thing that where it's really important to have full mobility.
Yeah, full flexibility.
Yep. And you think of other guys who've had that injury, and they just haven't come back the same way, have they? Do you remember when Wes Matthews was fucking Dame Lillard's CJ McCollum?
Yeah.
Before CJ McCollum, and then his Achilles went spoiling like a big rubber band, and he's just been. Last time I saw him, he looked like a mobile tank because he'd had to completely change his body and play a completely different game of basketball.
Like, touch is a fairly similar sport, and I have seen guys come back in touch with full mobility after an Achilles, like, just as springy as they were before, and just as much of that, not even just springiness, but it's that springy acceleration, it's like, like coming off a cut and then exploding. It's the same, very similar sort of change of direction movements that you get in basketball. Different directions, obviously, but, same sort of stuff. So I think it is possible. But the other thing about the coaching, though, is has anyone really expressed keenness for the Rockets job? It's been crickets, hasn't it?
I see that Vanderpool, who's like one of the assistants who often gets named in dispatches, is one of the people they're interviewing. The thing is, you know, they're going to try and they will pick someone cheap because Tillman doesn't want to spend any money. So that will almost definitely go to a first time assistant. Stepping up to head coach just because they can't afford the
Van Gundy
to pay the freight on anybody higher profile than that.
Yeah, it's funny because it sounds like Van Gundy's been wanting to get back into coaching for the last 2 or 3 years, and he even did that, you know, Team USA qualifying. Jeff.
Well, Jeff's been wanting to go back for 13 years, but no one will have him.
No, it doesn't seem like it, does it?
Even Stan's been saying, I'd come back if it was the right deal. But that, why go for a big name that's really expensive when you can, you know, go for somebody cheaper?
And, yeah, Tibbs in New York will be fascinating because he's sort of, like, if he can't do something half decent in New York, then the argument to keep going back to a coach that had a really good stint 10 years ago, like, really diminishes, doesn't it? Like, why not go for the Nick Nurse? You know, why not take a shot at the next Nick Nurse? Or,
well, I can tell you why, because the front office guy has the same management as the coach. That's exactly why. I mean, there's so much of these decisions. I mean, I was thinking to myself, I wonder who Doc Rivers' management is, and I wonder if he shares management
with Elton Brand
Elton Brand or anybody else in the Sixers hierarchy. Because, I mean, Tibbs is a CAA guy, isn't he? And
he's
running Knicks people now.
Yep. I think just about everyone at the Knicks is CAA now. So, does Rich Paul get Executive of the Year?
I was literally going to say that. I mean, it was interesting to this week, LeBron casually sort of let slip in an interview, you know, he was talking about how great AD was, and he says, you know, it really vindicates my decision to bring him here. And it's like, so now you want to be known as the GM after having all your mates in the media say, LeBron's not the GM, it's Rob Pelinka's the GM, or Magic is the GM. Nah, man, that's not quite how that works.
I saw a really serious story this week that was like, Rob Pelinka should absolutely win Executive of the Year. And I'm like, how the fuck can you write that with a straight face? Come on. You know, they might as well raise a clutch banner instead of a Lakers banner this year, you know? Maybe that's where
how they get it done. They get it done.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Lakers don't care. It's just like, don't they equal, if they win this one, they equal the Celtics. So, yeah, the investment in LeBron has definitely been good for them. That's for sure.
Yeah. And, of course, they get AD for the next 10 years if all this goes well. So they win now and they win forever sort of thing.
Yeah, how long do you reckon LeBron could be an effective player? Like, he's literally the best player in these finals. if not the clear best player, but the equal best player. Like, I think AD's done as much, but, you know, someone said today, oh, you know, AD's, you know, one of the best power forwards ever. You know, he's already better than Nowitzki. And the person pointed out gently, well, AD won, like, played 11 finals games before he paired up with LeBron. You know, Nowitzki carried that Mavs team year after year after year pretty deep into the finals by himself.
Not having any friends doesn't necessarily mean that you're more deserving of rewards, though. I mean,
even relevant. Some players just, like, we had sort of like generationally great players, right? And there was the one guy that was sort of coming up when I was in the Opens. He was the LeBron of touch football. Didn't matter who you put him with, he was just the dominant player. And he could play with nobody, he could play in a superstar team, and he was just a gun. And then the guy that came along next, who was sort of seen as the clearly the best player, only really had success with when he was paired with certain types of other players. Like, he couldn't do it all by himself. He needed to have basically someone that was super quick next to him that he could really unleash his weapons. And if he didn't have that, you could sort of shut him down. Like, he wasn't quite the all-round, it didn't matter. And that's not to say that he wasn't good. It's just that he did have limitations. And LeBron's sort of one of those freaks that just doesn't really have any limitations. It doesn't matter. You know, he fits into wherever you put him in.
That's the second time you've brought it back to your coaching career, which I think is really impressive. This is the week after you pitched yourself for the OKC job. And this week, folks, you might not be aware of this, but in private messages, Bezo has declared himself the Marcelo Bielsa of touch football. Really, a level of narcissism. I know that's a big word, and they don't necessarily teach big words in the Queensland school system, but the level of narcissism to decide that you're the Marcelo Bielsa of touch football.
And then I knew that was going to get used against me.
Then Photoshop some text messages between other people that claim that they immediately thought of him when Bielsa's name came up. The thing about Bielsa is that he's a weird, gurning ideologue with dubious emotional intelligence who's got a whole bunch of fringe nutter ideas that failed everywhere he went and had to be adapted by other more, you know, rational and centered people with actual personal skills in order to win something with them. So, yeah, that's definitely you, my guy.
I like how Leeds went from, you know, two free-flowing, high-scoring games to a 1-0 win.
A 1-0 win will do.
Yeah. Cool. We're in the top ten of the Premier League. I am not complaining after three.
Well, it was against Sheffield United, who are another team from Yorkshire and another team that got promoted from the Championship. At least they were the year before, and of course they overperformed last year under Chris Wilder, who's as anti a Marcelo Bielsa figure as you can imagine. This kind of gruff northern bastard, but also was using a whole lot of interesting tactical shit that tactics nerds were really excited about, overlapping fullbacks and things like that. So it was kind of they kind of cancelled each other out, and Leeds were lucky to get away with it in the end.
I guess that's the key of being a non-bounce team in the Premier League, like staying in that middle and sort of establishing yourself in the Premier League is winning those games against the middle class, isn't it? The middle and lower class.
Sheffield United have lost their first three games after being, you know, the tactics nerds' darlings last year. So, I mean, they've been unlucky, but there's only so long your luck can run in the Premier League before you start being in the shit.
What's the sort of hole? Like, how many games off the pace do you have to?
Grafton's a hole.
Like, you know, if you're 5 games back, like I'm trying to articulate it. Like, how far out of the relegation zone
if you get 40 points, that's usually enough to avoid relegation in a 38 round, which is, you know, 20 teams. They play each other home and away. That's how many games you play. You play 38 games. And if you get 40 points, I think only once or twice has a team that has got more than 40 points been relegated. And one of them was Leeds United. West Ham 1 year. They were really unlucky that year. Just so happened it was a year where the top of the table were all shit. And in fact, West Ham was safe last year and they got less than 40 points, I think, because right now at the top of the Premier League, the best teams are getting shitloads of points. They're winning lots and lots of games. But that might not be the case this year, given that Man City have had a particularly crap start to the year. They beat Wolves, but again, Wolves are a bit like Sheffield United in that they were overperformers last year and they might have bounced back to earth this year. They got beaten by West Ham 4-0 this week. And then last week, Man City went out to play Leicester and went 2 goals up and then got beaten 5-2, which is the kind of comedy that everyone delights in.
That's a big turnaround.
That's a big old... That's like Ranieri 2015-16 levels of overperformance. So Leicester are top of the league, which is interesting. We could be having this, we could be doing this all over again. The 5,000-1 season all over again.
That would be good.
Well, unfortunately for people who want that, I think that Liverpool are still good.
Yeah.
That 5,000-1 season was predicated on all the other big teams being shit that year. Like, everyone had it was on a downturn. So
yeah. See, the chances Mourinho of got, yeah. all of them doing. Having a bad year again are probably pretty slim.
No, but you know, one or two of them might, and then they'll might finish second or third.
Yeah, so it looks like the NBA season's pretty much done and dusted.
It does feel a bit like that. I mean, the last time that, you know, the last time a team as much of an underdog as the Heat won a finals against the Lakers, it required Kobe going out there shooting on sight, trying to win the finals MVP first and win the finals second, and pissing off all the players around him. You're not going to get that level of of narcissism out of LeBron and AD. They're working together. They're not. It's this isn't a Shaq and Kobe situation.
Yeah. Well, the fact that LeBron is absolutely conscious of his legacy and Davis wants to win one just so he can be talked about in that sort of, you know, top player echelon conversation. You know, the fact that he hasn't won one doesn't sort of...
Or just to win. I mean, the point of playing basketball is to win. And if you get a chance to win, whereas that Shaq and Kobe team were at the end of their cycle. They were sick to death of each other. They'd played each other, you know, they'd already racked up, you know, a whole bunch of titles in a row. And none of them wanted to cede. I mean, it might be a different question if this was the third title the Lakers were going for, and the question of who's getting credit for it and who's taking credit for it.
Yeah, and we're not going to see you know, LeBron and Wade pretending to cough at Dirk, and you know, stirring up the bench in Game 3 when they think that they've got the whole thing. You know, LeBron's just going to take care of business and get his ring and go and see his family.
And by the time, you know, even assuming the Lakers win this one and the next one and the one after that, by the time they get to that point, that disease of me stuff, that, you know, I'm not getting enough credit for this, you know, that the Shaq and Kobe stuff that ripped apart that team, that's not going to happen to the AD LeBron Lakers, because LeBron will be on the fringes of retirement.
Yeah.
He will very much be deferring on the court to AD. AD, it'll be AD's team with LeBron helping rather than LeBron's team with AD helping.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to see whether LeBron wants to play till he's like 45 as a 15-minute-a-game player. Like, you know, 15 sort of awesome minutes, but like the dude is just so well-rounded. He could just do whatever he wants, I think.
I think because he spent his entire career being physically better than everybody else, I think once he's not...
You think that'll be the point?
That'll be the point at which it's not as much fun anymore. And I wonder how quickly he'll find other things to do. And knowing that, you know, that the sooner he stops being a player, the sooner he can own a team and, you know, do all the stuff that he wants to do next.
Yeah. Which team do you reckon he'll want to buy? He'll want the Cavs, won't he?
He'll want the Cavs, but I don't think he'll get the Cavs.
Mm.
Unless the arse drops out of the predatory lending market, which would be lovely. It couldn't happen to a nicer bloke.
Dan
Gilbert got COVID. I don't know if he was at the super spreader event.
Yeah, I was going to say there might not be a United States of America by the time LeBron wants to own a team.
Anyway, this isn't a political podcast.
But, no.
I couldn't think of a better group of people to be having COVID running through their social gathering.
Yep. Yeah, I just don't really have my... Because it'd be good to see if Cassell got a head coaching job. That would be good, I think.
Would it depends what the job would be.
Houston would be the only one. Like you said, they're gonna underpay, so that the job that he would probably get would be that one.
Ty Lue goes somewhere else though. Is Cassell next on the bench?
Yeah, I guess so. Jason Kidd jumps across the, you know, the dressing rooms at Staples and coaches the Clippers.
Goes down the corridor. Yeah, that Jason Kidd is going to...
Yeah, that storyline just died in the arse, didn't it?
Yeah, it turns out that Frank Vogel, good coach. And yeah, I don't know. Jason Kidd's keeping a very, very low profile because he knows that you know, it's not time for him. And he's gonna get a ring. I mean, the people who are going to get a ring, Jason Kidd's going to get a ring. Fucking Dion Waiters is going to get a ring. I mean, he was going to get a ring anyway, technically, because he started the season on the Heat. Although I suspect Miami probably weren't going to give him one, given that instead of a ring, they'll give him a ring-shaped weed gummy.
Well, J.R. Smith having two rings is pretty wild.
J.R. Smith hasn't played enough time. I suspect there's a true waiters too, but I don't think J.R. has played enough court minutes.
Rondo gets, you know, a second one with the second team.
Rondo deserves one too because he's been excellent.
He might have been their third best player, I guess.
Well, they have to take him seriously as a shooter, and that's not been something you could say about Rondo. I mean, you think back to him getting run out of the Mavs because he was impossible to work with, and that wasn't that long ago.
I do wonder whether that's actually helped the second part of his career though, where he went to a side. And basically, a coach went, "Nah, mate, you're not the Rondo that almost won a playoff series against LeBron. You're just not that player anymore. So stop acting like you are. Get the fuck out of here." And it sort of made him go into the Vince Carter second part of his career role player.
Because the first part of his career, he was basically KG's youngin in the Celtics, and he was just kind of mirroring that kind of behavior. And I'm pretty sure it made him have to face up to the idea that behaving like KG is not always a plus.
Mm.
In fact, it's generally not a plus in any kind of polite company.
Well, he did have that series against the Cavs where he was the best player in the series, in a series that had, you know, LeBron and KD and Pierce and, you know, all those legends. So, and then he did his knee. So, yeah, well, he gets another one.
KCP gets another one. JaVale McGee gets another one. Dwight Howard gets a ring.
No, that's probably the worst thing. I just don't like Dwight. But yeah.
It's weird that the one moment where we thought that the Heat had an opportunity in this series was the first 5 minutes of the first game, yeah, where the Heat were just targeting the shit out of Dwight, and they went up like 23-15. And then Vogel went, okay, we're just going to take the big man off the field, put him on the side, go small, and that was the end of that.
Yeah, and then
Lakers went on like a 70-3 run, and that was the end of that game.
Yeah. Stood on Dragic's foot. What happened to Bam? He just popped a shoulder, didn't he?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a rotator cuff kind of thing.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Yeah. Now, it would have been good just to see, like, the Lakers, like you said, the Lakers probably just, the talent is just too much, but that the Heat would have made them just grind, you know, had to absolutely grind it out. And, you know, unless Myers Leonard becomes Steph Curry, there's not really much left.
They did do a little bit with Myers Leonard in the second game. He started, he hit a three.
Yeah.
And that was the bad thing.
And that was it.
It was about all they got. There's a reason he left Portland. But, you know, it's a shame to kind of end like that. It's a bit like when there's an absolute shellacking in a grand final. It does kind of leave you with a, and it takes you a while to kind of not to see the whole year as a bit of a flop.
And the playoffs have been so enjoyable. That's the thing. Like, there's been heaps of good series, heaps of really good storylines and narratives.
Although when you look back, none of them involved the Lakers, because the Lakers just took care of business in every single one of them. That was just 4-1, 4-1, 4-1.
Yeah.
This will be a 4-1 as well, it looks like.
Shall we come back and talk some Toony Tunes?
Well, firstly, we have to do a comprehensive coverage of the Rugby League and the AFL finals.
Mm-hmm.
The AFL and the Rugby League finals are happening.
The only thing I've got to say about the finals is it's going to be pretty funny if just by pure fluke they give the Brisbane Lions a home grand final. I can't think of anything that would wind Victorians up much more.
No, it won't, because they'll just do what they did in the early aughts.
What's that?
Fitzroy!
That's right. Yeah, I was going to say, actually, I do not want what would wind up Victorians more is if Perth got a home grand final. That would probably wind up Victorians more, because they can't even claim that.
Well, and Perth people can't even come over to watch the game either, so
yeah. It's kind of...
The best case would be if it's two complete out-of-state teams and they get a crowd of, like, three people.
Yeah. Just a little side podcasting note. If you're not following Kimber's sort of non-topical cricket podcast called Red Inca, he had a great one with Jeff Lemon about the literally about Channel 9 from sort of start to finish of how they did commentary and why it was so important and why people were so angry / disappointed, disillusioned. And it wasn't because the commentary was just bad. It was because they had done so much to help cricket and make cricket a thing that it's slowly descending into this, you know, boys' club.
This footy showification. And because it was so obviously counter to what Richie Beno stood for.
Mm.
It was so clearly not what he believed in terms of cricket commentary, where you let the game speak for itself and you never talk about yourself. And these fucking wankers coming in endlessly talking about themselves and the hijinks they got up to with their old mates.
And one of the interesting things that I don't think was in Lemon's piece was that evidently Richie used to do like an induction. And if you came onto the commentary team, he would, like, sit in the back of the box and, you know, give you notes, yeah. A la, you know, like a movie studio, you know, giving the director notes. And I guess as he got older, it became harder and harder for him to maintain that level of integrity. Well, so
executive producers kind of liberated some of that control off him. He was no longer the captain of the commentary team. I mean, a lot of that was kind of Billy Birmingham, you know, writing, you know, almost kayfabe into the background. But it was it was based in truth. I mean, he was the captain of the commentary team, and he did feel like he was their captain coach.
So the when Taylor joined the commentary team, the production changed, and Taylor was the first one that came on that they basically said, you know, just off you go, just go and do it. And no one gave him notes. So the producer before that, and the producers all the way back to when they started, the producers would literally give the commentary team notes about, you know, this was good, this was bad, less of these sort of jokes, you know, stop calling him this. And the commentators
style
would...
Style guide. Was it like a house style guide?
Even just feedback. I don't think they're trying to make everybody the same, but, you know, stop talking about this and, you know, people aren't going to care about this. And I guess they're looking at ratings and they know what rates well and what combinations of commentators rates well and stuff like that.
But it's not even that. If you did that, then fucking Warnie talking about pizza toppings is what rates amongst a certain audience. And I feel like that's, you know, that where we've ended up with Warnie talking about pizza topping instead of cricket commentary is kind of, well, you get what you deserve.
So, and the reason I wanted to bring that round was, I can't remember who was talking about it, but it might have been Collins and Jeff Lemon talking about the BBC doing some of the T20s on free-to-air this year. And they were talking about, you know, Sky's got this very sort of high-level commentary. Like, they basically make an assumption that if you're paying to watch the cricket, you've got a good cricket knowledge and, you know, you're quite happy to listen to in-depth discussions about tactics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then when the BBC
It's much like Sky's Formula One coverage compared to like a big free-to-air channel. And it's much like, say, Fox Sports coverage of the V8 Supercars compared to Channel 10's coverage. I mean, there's an expectation that if you're paying for this, you're probably an enthusiast and you probably care and you don't want your intelligence insulted. Whereas on a free-to-air channel, they kind of can't leave anybody behind.
Well, so the BBC did a couple of T20s this year after the World Cup, and they obviously they're using a lot of the Test Match Special commentators, so they're experienced commentators and would normally do that like high level commentating. But instead, because they knew that they were broadcasting to a whole bunch of people that were maybe watching the second or third game of cricket, they were actually explaining a lot of like they really not dumbed it down, but they were like, this is why they are doing this, you know?
Yeah.
This is why you're suddenly seeing the field change in this particular way. This is why we're getting this batting combination now. And really try to be inclusive to everyone rather than just the core people that always watch cricket.
And that's really important. You think about how long it took you as a kid to figure out the rules of cricket.
Mm.
Like, I literally had a dog-eared second-hand copy of the like how to play cricket, which had the rules of cricket in there. Because if you try and work it out from watching it on television, I remember we had some in my final years of undergrad. We had some flatmates who were from Texas, like exchange students, and they were trying to understand cricket from watching it. And it's they were big baseball fans, and you know that it made perfect sense to, you know, baseball is a relatively easy sport to figure out from watching it, you know, in terms of the balls and strikes and all that kind of stuff. You know, why is it a strike if you foul it off for the first two but not the second but third? But you know that sort of stuff you can get around. But cricket is so fucking impenetrable, and you can't, if you don't bring your audience with you, you're not going to have an audience on free-to-air television. And that's kind of why when you have, unfortunately, I'd rather they did that kind of very, you know, talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old kind of coverage than the other type of coverage that free-to-air television tries to do, which is the airdrop in celebrities who are completely unfucking related and have them talk, you know, vaguely in concert about what they're watching in a way that has got nothing to do with the event and everything to do about the television show they're cross-promoting.
And the thing was, Sky was still broadcasting those T20 games. So if you were a hardcore cricket person, you probably had Sky already and you weren't going to watch the BBC coverage. You were going to watch the Sky coverage where people were going to talk in your language.
How hardcore a fucking enthusiast do you want your coverage to be if it's a fucking T20 game?
20, that's right. Yeah, it's literally the gateway drug of cricket. That's what it is. Yes.
And to be fair, that's me. Channel 10 did that job really well with the Big Bash, because their coverage wasn't too T20 technical. I mean, there was a bit footy. There was a depending on the audio on the commentators they had. There was a bit of footy showification. Anytime you had fucking Mark War on there, it was always a bit of a disaster.
Mm. But even the other commentators knew that though. Like,
yeah.
You know, as when he was on and he'd say, "Oh, who's that player?" And it's like, "Mate, he's in your fucking T20 squad." You know,
like, you're the national selection. You fucking idiot.
He's one of the players that your fucking selection team. Fact, you know, just shit like that used to just make
as a selection thing.
Made me laugh. I swear the other commentators had like a, you know, like a running thing where they're like, "I wonder who we can get in the Australian national T20 side this year. We'll just talk this guy up to Mark Waugh all the time and see if he goes into the selection meetings going, yeah, Adam Zampa, mate, he's fucking awesome."
Well, a bit like that correlation study that showed that James Harden played worse in cities that had really good strip clubs. They should have done a correlation to see whether people who got picked in the Australian team were more likely to have played in games that Mark Waugh commentated on, because they're the only ones in front of him. Because he doesn't have object permanence. If a player is playing in a game that he's not watching, they don't exist.
Or if you played well and there was a Greyhounds meet on, then you know you're probably not going to get that much attention from War. Who would have the Greyhounds on the phone just beyond the cameras?
Yes, it's three members of his playing squad who apparently are dish lickers.
All right, Doc. That was cool. I'll catch you on the flip side.